As I recall it, the reports we received really were from two sources. One, embassy sources out in the field, as well as through the UN. It was not the U.S. mission being the exclusive. Although Bhutan, if I recall, came back and gave a full report to Goldberg, which was duly reported in detail, but we had gotten things as we went along.
Because I think the reason I ask this is he suggests in his memoirs that the report of what he had arranged didn't really until several days later.
Yeah. I don't think that's true, quite frankly. I think that this is probably a reflection of Bhutan believing that the report had not been given sufficient seriousness, if I can put it that way. Candidly, that move was not welcome. And secondly, viewed from the seventh floor, there existed, this is an overstatement, but not too much of one, kind of a siege mentality, if I can put it that way. And therefore, every other day there was some new initiative. Now, it was different when you've got, after all, the Secretary General of the United Nations that takes initiative. But there were so many would-be negotiators and mediators, French sources, private sources. In the months that I spent with that Harriman Committee, we were sifting out all of these proposals, or so-called proposals. And Rusk was very fond of saying, and I think he was right, that there was no lack of communication. It was just what was communicated.
Is it accurate to say that this experience further increased further a rather negative attitude toward Bhutan, especially on the part of President Johnson?
Yes. President Johnson felt very strongly, in my judgment. I heard him at meetings critical of the UN, and by the UN, the symbol was the Secretary General taking the kind of initiative that was not welcome. And moreover, there was another feeling, and that is that the reports that were coming back tended to accentuate the positive, when in fact the feeling was that there was no real change in the position. And of course, that's the tendency, and I don't make this judgment about Bhutan, yes or no. It's the tendency of all people who tend to want to play a third-party role.
Which takes me now back a few years to another even more serious incident, and that was the Cuban Missile Crisis. At that time, Bhutan addressed letters to the American president and to Khrushchev, to which the Soviet side replied rather quickly and the American side a little later. My question is this. Again, in another interview, it has been suggested that the dispatch of these letters was worked out in direct cooperation with the United States. What is your view on that?
My recollection is that we came to a conclusion at some point that the conduit of the Secretary General would be useful in information back and forth between ourselves and the Soviet Union. And in that sense, we made it very, very clear that we wanted the Secretary General to play a role. And in fact, it was through the Secretary General that we got the first word that the Soviets had decided to turn back their ships. This is very, I could elucidate something in this regard someday. I hope to write it. The most dramatic part was Stevenson and the exposure of all of these photographs and culminating in his famous retort of that he was willing to wait until hell froze over for Mr. Zorin's response. Adlai Stevenson had prepared, we had prepared, a 65-page speech for Adlai Stevenson. I had flown to New York on the night before with all of those and some military people with me on a military plane with all of those aerial photos. And we had written the speech on that basis, and he was scheduled to give it at 3 o'clock, whatever that day happened to be, the record will show. At about noon, I had informed Harlan Cleveland that Stevenson was very firm in wanting to make this speech, and that we felt that we should not make this speech at this time because we were awaiting word from the Secretary General as to the Soviet reply. Stevenson got
to his letter or to yes.
Yeah, well, the Russian reply to the letter, which it basically would have amounted to, well, it did. The response was that they were going to back off,
right.
And that was very. We felt the Secretary General was playing a positive role in this regard. In fact, Uthant, I think, recuperated part of his position with the U.S. government as a result of the role he played at that particular juncture. So Cleveland called President Kennedy, and Kennedy was absolutely convinced that Stevenson should not make the speech. And I was instructed by the president, who was watching everything on television, to tell Stevenson he was not to make that speech. Walking over to the Security Council chamber, I said, "Governor, the president does not want you to make the speech. And the reason is that we are waiting word, and we don't want your speech to become the pretext for the Russians saying, after that, we're going to say no." Well, he blew up and said no, he was going to make the speech anyway. And I said, and Dick Pederson said, "You can't do that, Governor." So I immediately got to the Security Council chamber. Outside the Security Council chamber, there is a battery of two or three telephones. So I called Washington and I said to Cleveland, "He's going to go ahead, and there's only one way in which we can prevent him from doing it." He said, "How's that?" I said, "You've got to get the president on the line." I said, "I'll go get him." He said, "All right, we'll get the president." "President, get on the line." I went into the chamber. I said, it was just then 3 o'clock. I said, "Governor, the president wants to talk to you." And he said, "God damn it, Joe, tell Kennedy. Kennedy, I can't talk to him. The meeting is about to begin." And I said, "I can get the meeting postponed, Governor, for 15 minutes. You can't turn down talking to the president," is what I said to him. And he grumbled and he went out. So I went to Zorin and said, "Mr. Ambassador, as you know, our two governments are in communication with one another on this matter. And the president is now speaking to Governor Stevenson, and would you mind delaying them?" "Oh," he said, take whatever time you need. "I will not start the meeting until you give me the signal." This was his response. Well, while he was in the booth, I took that 65-page speech and X'd out about 40 pages. Wanting him to be able to give something so he could make his speech. So he came back grumbling, and I said, "Governor, I've excised a good deal of it, and I think that if you just make this statement right here, you won't fall into the trap, and I'm sure it's consistent with what the president's had to say," which he grumbled. We started the meeting. He made a very brief statement, the record will show, a few pages, whatever it was. Then, while this was going on, we got word from, we suspended the Security Council, but we got word that the Russians had responded and that they had responded favorably, and we got this through the Secretary General. So we then, Pedersen and myself, went into the side room. There's a little side room of the Security Council, and we said to him, "Now, Governor, you can pull out all the stops, everything you got in this speech, get all of this, these photographs out, and just go right ahead. And above all, create a lot of tension in the council room. Absolutely crisis atmosphere is what we want from you," is what we told him. So he did precisely that, and using all of the, but on his own, those famous quotations, none of that was in the text. He did that on his own. And that's the story of the Secretary General. We felt that he had been very, very helpful in the circumstance. And that's from the top on down, because Kennedy himself was very conscious that the focus was on Uthant at that moment.
Let me ask one more question in that connection.
I don't know whether you'd ever heard this story.
No, actually not. Harlan Cleveland had told a somewhat different story of a different stage.
Yeah. Harlan was in Washington. I was in
New York.
That's
right. He said at one point he was holding the phone, more or less, and the president was watching.
That's correct. That's correct. This is this incident.
Same incident.
Three people involved.
Right.
And then Stevenson got out.
Jim,
why I wasn't fired by either Goldberg or Stevenson, I'll never know.
It didn't hurt you. Going on, one more question in this connection, though. It has subsequently become known, just really in the past couple of years, that a letter was prepared in Washington for Uthant to send in the event that the crisis was not resolved. At that point. And that letter was never used, but because the crisis was resolved. But it would have been another opportunity for Uthant as a third party to, in fact, prevent the worst from happening.
Yeah.
It's not clear where that was done. Was that done in the State Department?
It was done in the State Department, and the reason for it, Jim, is very clear. It was resolved, as you say, and largely in picking out the best of the two letters that Khrushchev sent,
right,
and the contacts between Scali and Kennedy and Dobrynin. But earlier, as you were developing contingencies, even if that direct attempt between the United States and the Soviet Union had failed, we were all looking for something else, at least by way of perception. And therefore, the UN as an institution in that regard would have provided additional time. You never really, that was contingency on contingency, so to speak. You never had to resort to it simply because it got resolved.
But the draft letter was prepared and sent up to New York.
Yeah. I don't know about whether it was sent up to New York, but it was prepared within the context of the whole committee. And I don't recall now, you know, which one of us help put together and so on, but it was there.
And it was a further indication that there was a recognition of the utility of the Secretary General in a crisis like this.
That was an ace in a hole. Not that we felt that if the situation had failed bilaterally, the UN could resolve it. It was that the instrumentality could be shown as something still going on, and therefore obviate the need for military confrontation at that particular moment. And much to the credit of the United States in that regard, as evidence of how far it was willing to go to avoid what would have been World War III.
Now I'd like to go ahead from Uthant to his successor and to the election or selection of Kurt Waldheim as the next Secretary General. Could you just give the background of how, again, Washington approached this election?
Sure. We felt that we wanted a stronger Secretary General. We were still deeply committed to the notion of the active role of the institution, despite the fact that you'd had this changed composition. We also were looking for someone that we felt that we could work with and was not necessarily oriented by experience to the third world posture. We'd had that, and on the whole, it was a mixed bag, so to speak, as we've focused on a number of these specific areas. But not an unadulterated failure in this regard. There was some good, some bad. The hope was that you could get a man in the position that could stand up to pressures. In this regard, there were candidacies that came forward, and our strong choice was Max Jacobson. But coming out so would be the kiss of death, because you had to work this out, as I've indicated, with the Soviets. And therefore, our whole strategy at that time, as it was previously, was to allow the candidacies to come forward, knowing that there would be and was, as there was with respect to Uthant, informal consultations by the permanent members, which is the normal procedure in this regard. And we played Max Jacobson, I think, very, very carefully, really allowed the Soviets to make their own decision without our making him our candidate. Well, when that didn't work out, the name of all time came up.
Just a minute. Did the Soviets indicate why Jacobson was not acceptable?
No, no. Our own feeling was that it was not so much any negative feeling about Jacobson per se as an individual, but it had to do more with Finnish-Soviet relationships. Although, secondly, at the time we were concerned. There was a strong anti-Israeli vein in Soviet policy. One of Jacobson's grandparents was Jewish, and we felt that that was influencing the Soviet Union at the time.
And were you aware of a fairly strong Arab disinclination?
Yes, and the Soviets were playing that particular game. So I think it's unfortunate. I think that Ambassador Jacobson felt that we had not pressed the Soviets sufficiently on this matter. In actuality, if we had, it would have been even worse, because they would have had a third reason to turn him down, namely that he had become the American candidate. And he was our candidate. He was our number one choice. I can remember the discussions with Secretary Rusk on this whole matter. Waldheim was always down to the number two category. We knew Waldheim because he had been for a long time the Austrian representative to the UN, and he had certainly made himself known to us throughout that whole period beforehand.
Now, the inevitable question. To your knowledge, no checks were made with regard to any records on Mr. Waldheim?
No.
Why not?
Well, I don't know that why not checks in the sense of the normal kind of check. I don't know that we. I think the general feeling was that these people were known, and I'm sure in some part of the intelligence agency, people were looking at it from an intelligence point of view. But I'll be very candid with you. I certainly was not made aware of anything, but this does not preclude that at the Secretary of State's level or at the National Security Council level that some intelligence assessment was made. But in any event, our intelligence services didn't unearth the problem that arose later on. There was certainly no evidence of an unbalance on the part of Waldheim. Waldheim was a very careful diplomat in that pre-Secretary General period. He was viewed as an individual who had open lines both to the Soviet Union as well as the United States. And above all, you had the question of the neutrality of Austria, and Austria being a friendly Western state. So there were, Waldheim had a good many things going for him. But I can't answer the question as to why there weren't checks of the kind that might possibly have exposed all this.
And what was your ongoing assessment of Waldheim as the Secretary General?
I mean, once he became Secretary
right.
General?
Mm-hmm.
One, he sought to balance between the U.S. and the USSR. Two, we felt that he was subject to pressures from the Soviet Union, but we also felt that he was subject to our own pressures as counter-pressure, that he was the kind of man who was responsive to this kind of thing, and that that his whole approach was largely pragmatic in the sense of the survivability of the Secretary General, but did not have a strong independent commitment to the institution per se, as say a Dag Hammarskjöld, in sharp contrast, mm-hmm. sharp contrast. Mm-hmm. Now granted, it's a different period of time in the evolution of the organization, but no, one didn't detect that sort of a, more in the whole classical 19th century traditional diplomatic approach.
And never any real evidence of leaning particularly toward one side or toward another?
No, there were times when we felt that he succumbed to Soviet pressure more than he should have, but basically he was down the middle somewhere.
And I wanted to ask a related question, not directly relevant to the Secretary General, but to this question of the Soviet presence in the Secretariat, which has actually, after you left the State Department, caused a great deal of trouble in terms of the financial support.
Sure.
But my question to you is, in your years, how did you view this, starting really, I suppose, with Dobrynin, who started in the Secretary General, in the Secretariat. How did you view this as a real problem in terms of the United Nations, as jeopardizing the confidence that you could place in the organization or not?
We felt that, A, it was a major problem in perception, particularly as it related to the American Congress, point one. Secondly, we felt that it became an increasingly greater problem as the UN, particularly in the very bad votes that we experienced in the General Assembly, began to appear more and more as the instrumentality of the non-aligned, and i.e., in the eyes of others, the Soviet Union itself. And third, we went through a difficult McCarthy period in the earlier days, a question of the use of the UN for purposes of espionage and counter-espionage. We felt that there was really no real classified information that was available, that which was available was really very tightly held at the Secretary General's level, and moreover, whether it was under Uthant or whether it was certainly under Hammarskjöld, and I'm less in a position to make a judgment on Waldheim in this regard, but even with Waldheim, we didn't really have notion that classified information was being spilled to the Russians from that particular level. And each Secretary General was very, very careful in his day-by-day operations. He dealt with the undersecretaries normally on an individual basis. Whenever there was a collective a staff meeting, if you will, nothing of any real sensitivity took place. And that was a standard operating procedure for as long as I can remember. But it became an increasing problem simply because of the more negative environment, among other things, that had developed with respect to the UN within the United States, who was the prime support, financial support of the organization. And moreover, we had, quite frankly, whereas in the earlier period we Americans occupied most of the important positions, pretty soon the thing evolved in such a way that in the personnel end or on the information end or whatever it might be, you had a distribution that it was more reflective of the changed composition of the UN itself, and therefore viewed with less of the commitment to the international servant, but largely a place where nation states put old diplomats to rest.
Right. Now, we don't have too much time left, but if I may, I'd like to...
We got about 8 minutes.
About 8 minutes. Very quickly to the 1967 war in the Middle East and ask you a couple of questions on that. And I'd like to start, the. It's often said that there was a remarkable series of mistakes made by the different parties which perhaps led to the outbreak of the 1967 war. So my question is a general question first. What was your perception from the vantage point of IO of the situation in the Middle East in the early months of 1967? Leading up to the outbreak of the war?
Well, our perception was that A, tremendous increase in tension, B, a war of attrition that presumably was being pursued by the Arabs against Israel, and a situation whereby the Israelis felt that they were being more and more quartered in the situation. That was the general environment of the whole thing. Nobody expected the result of 6 days, but I can recall being in an NSC meeting before that occurred, and that is that our military assessment was that in the event of war between the Arabs and the Israelis, that the Israelis would win.
You did make that assessment?
Yes.
That assessment was made.
That assessment was made.
Now, immediately before the war broke out, the Soviet Union conveyed information that was clearly false.
Yes, that they were massing along the Syrian,
it was on the Syrian border.
Syrian border, yeah.
And the Soviet ambassador
conveyed that, or made a public statement to that effect, too.
Made a public statement, but it was also conveyed privately to both to Nasser, who was in Cairo, and to Sadat, who happened to be visiting Moscow at the time. My question is, to what extent did the United States make an effort to counter that information that was going to the Egyptians?
Both Israel and the United States at that time denied the buildup, conveyed this to the Secretary General, and had it conveyed all the way around that there was nothing to this, and the Israelis at that given period were very straightforward. They laid it all out, and the impression I have looking at that event in hindsight after these years, and that is that Nasser really didn't want to hear that he had a strategy and that was a part of the overall strategy, unfortunately. And the Soviets, I'm afraid, were part of that game, one way or another, either inadvertently or otherwise. But the Israelis were at great pains at that time to make it very clear that was not the case. And it was not the case. We, if I recall, we had checked it out on the basis of our own resources and were perfectly satisfied that no such buildup was occurring.
Now, it has also been suggested that Nasser made a mistake, and I'd like to ask what the assessment again was on the American side. His initial request, or at least that of his chief of staff for the withdrawal of UNAF, was only for a partial withdrawal. It didn't seem to cover all of the of the observation posts. At that time, and also in retrospective, is there a sense, or was there a sense on your part and in Washington, that Nasser had not really intended for this to lead to the war that it led to?
I would say that Nasser's calculation was that UNIF would be removed and that this would give him a freer hand. But once he then combined that with closing the straits, then one had to conclude that he was prepared to face the worst, because certainly the Israelis had made it very, very clear that such an action